and thank you for tuning in to the Mark and Aceto podcast. I am Mark and Aceto, and today's podcast is going to be the next part in my history of music series of 1966. I'm going through, I was originally going to plan going through July through September in this episode, but there's a lot of information I gathered up for these 3 months that I'm going to have to do one at a time here. So for today we're going to do July of 1966, and go from there. Anyway, without further ado, let's get started. July of 1966. As always, I want to announce my sources I use for this episode. I use Wikipedia. I used the book 1966, The Year the Decade Exploded by John Savage, published in 2015. I used the book Psychedelia, 101 Iconic Underground Rock Albums, 1966 to 1970 by Richard Morton Jack, published in 2017. I used the Beatles Anthology book from 2000. I put an article up on a website called groovyhistory.com, written by Jacob Chilton, and published on August 13th, 2019. And that's it for this one. Before I get started, let's now I want to announce this one thing. This happened around this period in 1966 right here, this event. It was brought up in the documentary, Netflix documentary, Echoes in the Canyon. It was around this time in 1966 when music producer Lou Adler, who produced such acts as Jan and Dean, Carole King, and the Mamas and Papas, and the Grassroots, he went to London to meet up with friend Andrew Luke Oldham, who was a producer and manager of the Rolling Stones. And Mick Jagger was present in the studio during this meeting. Adler had a copy of the Beach Boys album Pet Sounds, and also Paul McCartney came in the studio as well, and Adler played Pet Sounds for Andrew, Mick, and Paul, and it gave way to new ideas from Mick and Paul. Paul McCartney loved the album. It was stated that Pet Sounds made Paul McCartney cry. So, July, here's some events that took place and songs that were released, records. Working in the Coal Mine 45 was released by Lee Dorsey in July. Land of 1,000 Dances by Wilson Pickett was released. Cherry Cherry by Neil Diamond was issued. Outside Chance by the Turtles had come out. House in the Country by the Pretty Things was released. With a Girl Like You by the Troggs was released. How Could I Be Such a Fool by the Mothers of Invention. The famous novelty record, They're Coming to Take Me Away, Ha Ha, by Napoleon XIV was released. So it's like an A side was a song playing forward and the B side was a song playing backwards. Sometimes Good Guys Don't Wear White by the Standells was released. Los Angeles-based garage rock band Love released the 45 7-7ers back with number 14. 7-7ers was weird and intense and based on an LSD experience. New York's Velvet Underground, a band fronted by Lou Reed, releases the 45 I'll Be Your Mirror back with All Tomorrow's Parties. Both songs were lead sung by German singer, actress, model Nico. She was introduced to the band by artist Andy Warhol, and he happened to manage the band as well. Movie directing can also be included in Warhol's resume, as he directed the 1966 film Chelsea Girls, which starred Nico. Warhol suggested Nico to be the band's chanteuse, whatever the word is, an idea that the band consented reluctantly, reluctantly, both for personal and musical reasons. Los Angeles band The Association releases their debut album titled And Then Along Came the Association. Highlights from the album included Along Comes Mary and Cherish. Frank Sinatra releases a live album, Sinatra at the Sands. It was recorded at the Cobra Room in the legendary Sands Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada. Sinatra was accompanied by Count Basie and his orchestra. The album was produced by Quincy Jones. American folk singer Tim Hardin releases his debut album, Tim Hardin One. The album features his composition, Reason to Believe, which Rod Stewart made famous in 1971 and 1993. Capitol Records releases the infamous LSD album. It was an attempt to educate the masses about the drug in spoken word and music. The music was provided by Fire and Ice Limited, who released an album in August of 1966. The Los Angeles-based studio project ID Records records the Inner Sounds LP, which then was released in January of 1967. On July 1st, Sunshine and Superman, Back with the Trip, was released by Donovan 145. The Trip is a psychedelic record, LSD experience. July 2nd, the Rolling Stones released the 45 Mother's Little Helper, Back with Lady Jane in America. July 2nd, the Beatles become the first musical group to perform at the Nippon Budokan Hall in Tokyo. People protested their performance due to the fact people believed it was inappropriate for a rock and roll group to play at Budokan. July 3rd, the Beatles are making headlines again, this time at a concert in the Philippines that went bad. Not the concert really itself, but like the experience there. And I'm going to read it here to you from the Beatles anthology book in their own words. So Ringo starts off here. I hated the Philippines. We arrived there with thousands upon thousands of kids, with hundreds upon hundreds of policemen, and it was a little dodgy. Everyone had guns, and it was really like that hot Catholic gun Spanish inquisition attitude. George Harrison comments, as soon as we got there, it was bad news. There were tough gorillas, little men who had short sleeve shirts, like, and acted like very menacingly. The normal proceedings in those days were that because the mania was everywhere, we didn't pull up at an airport and get off the plane like normal people. The plane would land and it would go to the far end of the airfield where we would get off. Usually with Neo in our diplomatic bags, we carried our shaving gear and whatever in little bags, get in the car, bypass passport control, and go to the gig. Mal Evans with Brian Epstein and the rest would go and do our passports and all that scene. But when we got to Manila, a fellow was screaming at us, leave those bags there, get in this car. We were being bullied for the first time. It wasn't respectful. Everywhere else, America, Sweden, Germany, wherever, even though there was a mania, there was always a lot of respect because we were famous showbiz personalities. But in Manila, it was very negative vibe from the moment we got there off the plane. So we were a bit frightened. We got in the car and the guy drove off with us four, leaving Neil behind. Our bags were on the runway and I was thinking, this is it, we're going to get busted. Road manager Neil Aspinall here says, the army was there and also some thugs in short sleeve shirts over their trousers, and male had guns. You could see the bulges. These guys got the four Beatles and stuck them in the limo and drove off. And wouldn't let them take their briefcases with them. They left them on the runway, and those little briefcases had the marijuana in them. So while the confusion was going on, I put them in the boot of the limo that I was going in and said, "Take me to wherever you took the Beatles." George Harrison and St. Cyr. Then they took us away and drove us down to Manila Harbor, put us on a boat, took us out to a motor yacht that was anchored out in the harbor, and they put us in this room. It was really humid. It was Mosquito City, and we were all sweating and frightened. For the first time ever in our Beatle existence, we were cut off from Neil, Mao, and Brian Epstein. There was not one of them around, and not only that, but we had a whole row of cops with guns lining the deck around this cabin that we were in on a boat. We were really gloomy, very brought down by the whole thing. We wished we hadn't come here. We should have missed it out. Neil Aspinall comments again. It drove me to the end of a pier, and I got out of the car and said, "Where are they?" They pointed. "There they are." And there was a big boat miles away in the middle of the harbor. There were what seemed to be rival Manila gangs. One gang had taken them and put them on this boat to meet some people who weren't people putting on the show. It was all very strange, and I never really understood why they got put on a boat. George Harrison then comments again. "We have no idea why they took us to the boat. I still don't know what to this day." An hour or two later, Brian Epstein arrived really frustrated with the Philippine promoter, and he was yelling and shouting. Everyone was shouting, and then they took us off the boat, put us in a car, and drove us to a hotel suite. The next morning, we were woken up by bangs on the door of the hotel, and there was a lot of panic going on outside. Somebody came to the room and said, "Come on, you're supposed to be at the palace." We said, "What are you talking about? We're not going to any palace." "You're supposed to be at the palace. Turn on the television." We did, and there was life from the palace. There was a huge line of people either side of the long marble corridor with kids in their best clothing, and the TV commentator saying, "And they're still not here yet. The Beatles are supposed to be here." We sat there in amazement. We couldn't believe it, and we just had to watch ourselves not arriving at the presidential palace. Paul McCartney comments, "I went out on my own in the morning down to the kind of Wall Street area. I remember taking a lot of photographs because right up against it was the shantytown area. There were cardboard dwellings right up against this Wall Street, which I never seen so well juxtaposed. I got the camera out. Wow, this is good stuff. And I bought a couple of paintings from the shantytown as presents to go back home. And I went back to the hotel to have lunch. Everyone was up, and about then we were in our hotel room when they started saying, "You've got to go to the President's Palace now. Remember the engagement?" "That engagement?" We said, "No, no, no." The promoters with those white shirts with lace that everyone in Manila seemed to wear looked a little heavy to us. A couple of them carried guns, so it was a bit difficult. We were used to each different country doing it their own way. They were starting to bang on the door. "They will come, they must come," but we were saying, look, just lock the bloody door. We were used to it. It's our day off. We found out later that it was Imelda Marcos with her shoes and her bras waiting for us. Somebody had invited us, and we gracefully, we thought, had declined the offer, but there was a TV announcer, their equivalent of Richard Dimmelby, saying, "And the First Lady is waiting with the blue ladies," and it was like America. They had pink ladies and blue ladies and first ladies, and they were all waiting there. And pretty soon the famous pop group been raving, and we're going, shoot, nobody's told them. And the promoters are saying, well, you've got to go now. It's only a limo to get there. And we said, we can't. We stuck to our guns and sat the rest of the day out in the hotel. We turned the telly off and got on with our day off. Then Ringo says, personally, I didn't know anything about Madame Marcos having invited us to dinner, but we said no, and Brian Epstein had told her no. John and I were sharing a room, and we woke up in the morning and phoned out for eggs and bacon or whatever we were eating in those days. All the newspapers, because we always liked to read about ourselves. We were just hanging out in our beds, chatting, doing whatever we were doing, and time went by, so we called down again. Excuse me, can we have the breakfast? Still nothing happened. So we put the TV on, and there was a horrific TV show of Madame Marcos screaming, they've let me down. There were all these shots with the cameraman focusing on empty plates and up into the little kids' faces, all crying because the Beatles hadn't turned up. We very nicely had said no to the invitation. Neil Aspinall, the road manager here, says, I think they'd been invited, and Brian had told them, sent a telegram saying no. The Beatles didn't do that sort of stuff for anybody. They wouldn't go get involved in politics, and they wouldn't go to the palace, but it was ignored as if he hadn't said it. I remember waking up in the morning and having breakfast, and the television was on with the news that the Beatles were about to turn up at Imelda Marcos's party for a lot of children. It was saying, okay, they'll be here in 5 minutes. They were looking at each other and asking, what are they talking about? They didn't turn up. After it was all over, they hadn't turned up, and people were going crazy. Well, barmy, well, I don't know. Crazy, I guess it's another word. It means, we asked Brian what had happened, and he said, I canceled it. You weren't supposed to go there. It turned nasty in the Philippines. I didn't eat for 3 days. They would bring up food, and that was terrible. Even if it was cornflakes for breakfast, you'd pour the milk, and it would come out in lumps. They had given you sour milk. I remember once ordering dinner, and it came up one of those big trays with the rolled lid on it. And I rolled back the lid, and oh, just by the smell of it, I knew we couldn't eat it. Paul and I sneaked out there as well. We must have been very brave and very naive. We got in a car and drove for miles. It was like Manhattan for 5 minutes, and then a dreadful shantytown for a long way out. The sun sand dunes. We bought a couple of pictures, sat in the sand dunes, and had a smoke, and then drove back to the hotel with everybody freaking out, especially the security. Where have you been? How did you get out? Although people kept saying it was a failure in the Philippines, the Beatles did 2 gigs to a total of about 100,000 people after the Marcos thing, and all the fans had a really good time. They really enjoyed it. There were still thugs about organizing things, nothing to do with the army, but they seemed to be organizing the fans rather than us. The cars were going the wrong way, and dressing room was in a mess. And George Harrison comments, again, we had a big problem with the concert. Brian Epstein had made a contract for a stadium of so many thousand people, but when we got there, it was like the Monterey Pop Festival. There were about 200,000 people on the site. And we were thinking, well, the promoter is probably making a bit on the side out of this. We went back to the hotel really tired and jet-lagged and pretty cheesed off. I don't recall much of what happened after that until the newspapers arrived and we saw the TV news. Paul McCartney states, the next morning, someone brought a newspaper on the front, it just said in massive letters, "Beatles snub president." Oh dear. Well, we didn't mean to. We thought we will just say we're sorry. We were scheduled to leave Manila that morning, and as we were leaving the hotel, everyone was a bit nasty at reception, so we had a scuffle out as if we hadn't paid our bill. Ringo here comments, "Things starting to get really weird. Come on, get out of bed. Let's get packed. We're getting out of here." And as we got downstairs and started to get in the car, we really had no help. There was only one motorbike compared to the huge motorcade that brought us in. And George Harrison states, "It was Beatles snub first family. That's how they decided to present it. Nobody ever said, well, they were never asked. It was quite likely it was the promoter or the agent who had done a deal, brown-nosing Mrs. Marcos, probably. She was later quoted by saying, oh, I never liked them anyway. Their music is horrible. The whole place turned on us. We had people yelling and screaming when we tried to get out to the airport. Nobody would give us a ride. We couldn't get any cars there. There was nothing available. Finally, somebody managed to get a car or two, and they put our baggage in one, and we got in the other. We were driven to the airport. Two things were happening simultaneously. They were all the government officials or police who were trying to punch us and yelling and waving fists at us, and then underneath that were the young kids who were still around during the mania. Neil Aspinall, the road manager, again says, they were really putting obstacles in our way. When we were on the way to the airport, a soldier kept sending us round and round roundabout until in the end I told the driver to pull over. Paul McCartney says, we got down to the airport and found they turned the escalators off, so we had to walk up the escalators. What's wrong? We don't know. We're not sure. Would someone take the luggage then? There don't appear to be any luggage people around. It was a case of carry your own luggage, all right? Let's get out of here then, if that's what it's going to be. Behind a huge plate glass window, the sort of they have in airports, the taxi rank outside, there were all the Filipino taxi guys banging on the windows, and we're all going gibber gibber. Okay, I never heard that song before. Must be a Neil Aspinall here states, nobody would help us with all the equipment, so we started using the escalators, and then they stopped, so we had to lug off all the stuff up the stairs. And once we got it all up the stairs, the escalators started to work again. The Beatles were going to Delhi, and the equipment was going back to England. So at the check-in desk, we kept saying, okay, that's going to Delhi. And they kept putting it on the pile that was going to England. And then Mao jumped over to the counter and sorted it all out for us because nobody was going to do it. George Harrison states here, we were all carrying amplifiers and suitcases. Nobody was helping us to do anything. But the mania was going on with people trying to grab us and other people trying to hit us. We finally got checked in. It seemed like forever at the check-in desk. We eventually got into the departure lounge, which was a huge room, but then the thugs appeared again. The same people with the short sleeve shirts who had been shouting at us as soon as we had gone off the plane when we arrived in Manila, as well as Mal and Neil. We had Alf Bicknell with us helping out, and I saw him get punched by one of the thugs. There were a number of them coming up and to us, pushing and screaming, get over there. They forced us back, and then another one would come around the other way, doing it again. Get over there. I was trying to keep my eye on all the people, keep moving ahead of them, to stay out of their way. It was all really negative. I saw a couple of Buddhist monks and went and hid behind them. Ringo then states here, there was chanting with people hitting us all the way, and now at the airport they started spitting on us, and then there's a famous story of John and me hiding behind these nuns because we thought it's a Catholic country and they won't beat up the nuns. John Lennon in the States. All along the route to the airport, there were people waving at us, but I could see a few old men booing us. When they started on us at the airport, I was petrified. I thought I was going to get hit, so I hid with three nuns and two monks thinking that might stop them. As far as I know, I was just pushed around, but I could have been kicked and not known it. You treat like ordinary passenger. Ordinary passenger, we were saying, ordinary passenger, he doesn't get kicked, does he? I saw five in sort of outfits who were doing it, all the kicking and booing and shouting. I was petrified and pushed a lot. I was very delicate and moved every time they touched me. That was Brian's cock-up because he had the invitation given to him and declined it and never told us. And the next day they wouldn't accept that we declined it and were hustling and pushing us around at the airport. He wouldn't help and wouldn't help us with our bags. It was terrifying. Paul McCartney here states, we were quite frightened. Most of the aggression, luckily for us, was directed towards our people. I think Alvis got thrown down the stairs violently by one of them, but mostly it wasn't over, though they were annoyed. We felt a bit guilty, but we didn't feel it was our cock-up. Now, knowing more about their rigamy, what I think is that they had ignored our telling them we weren't coming. Let them just try and not come. We'll make it difficult for them. There was a group of nuns in the corner of the airport, and when all the fisticuffs broke out, and with the taxi drivers behind the plate glass window, we went over to the nuns. It was rather a nice little shot. Nuns and Beatles in the corner. We had a lot of common in many ways. Black outfits and little groups. Obviously in the same mold. We stood behind them. You have to get through them to get to us. You have to get through them, mate. They didn't actually protect us. They just stood there looking a bit bemused. Whenever they moved, we moved the other side of them. Neil Aspinall here states, all the thugs in their Hawaiian shirts were pushing and shoving and punching. It was dreadful. I'm sure nobody got badly hurt, but that was because we didn't fight back, so we got pushed and shoved. We knew not to fight back. If we had fought back, it couldn't have been very bad. It was very, very scary, and nothing like this had ever happened before. Nothing like this has ever happened since. George Harrison states, finally they announced the flight and we boarded the plane, and that was the greatest feeling, just to be on the plane. And there was a sense of relief. Then the plane sat there. Eventually there was an announcement on the speaker saying, well, Mr. Epstein and Mr. Evans and Mr. Morrow, Tony, who was our press agent at the time, get off the plane. They all had get off and they looked terrified. Mal went past me and the aisle, the plane breaking out in tears, and he turned to me and said, Till Lil, I love her. Lil was his wife. He thought that was it. The plane was going to go, and he would be stuck in Manila. The whole feeling was fucking hell. What's going to happen? Paul McCartney states, when we got on the plane, we were all kissing the seats. It was feeling as if we found sanctuary. We had definitely been in a foreign country where all the rules had changed and they carried guns, so we weren't too gung-ho about not at all. Then the announcement came over. Tony Barrow had to go back into the lion's den and then made him pay an amazing airport leaving Manila tax that I guess dreamed up. Strangely enough, I think it came to the same amount as the receipts on a trip. I think that was the story. The George Harrison states, we sat there for what seemed to be a couple of hours. It was probably only 30 minutes or an hour, but it was humid and hot. Finally, the Amy boarded. The front door was closed and the plane was allowed to leave. They took the money that we had earned at the concert, and that was it. We all got out there, and it was such a relief. I felt such resentment against those people. Paul McCartney states, I remember when we got back home, a journalist asked George, did you enjoy it? And he said, if I had an atomic bomb, I'd go over there and drop it on them. It was an unfortunate little trip, but the nice thing about it was that in the end, when we found out what Mark was in Imelda had been doing to the people, it was and the ripoff that the whole thing allegedly was. We were glad to have done what we did. Great, we must have been the only people who would ever dare to snub Marcos. That we didn't really know what we were doing politically until many years later. And Ringo states, we had fantasies that we were going to be put in jail because it was a dictatorship that was there in those days. Not a democracy. You lose your rights in a dictatorship no matter who you are. So we weren't going to get off the plane. Our people were allowed back on. And that was my first and last time in Manila. Road manager Neil Aspinall here states, I'm sure it made the band think hard about touring. It might have been one of the last nails in the touring coffin. Producer George Martin states, when they got out of the country, they said, never again, this is it. They said to Brian then that they would not tour again. Brian said, sorry, lads, we have to go get something fixed up for Shea Stadium. Oops, I mean, if we cancel you, are going to lose $1 million. Oops, and then they did do Shea Stadium. And John Lennon here states, no planes going to go through the Philippines with me on it. I wouldn't even fly over it. We'll just never go to any nut houses again. Right, July 4th. Los Angeles band The Lemon Spoonful releases the 45 Summer in the City. July 13th, Knock on Wood 45 is released by Eddie Floyd. July 15th, British band The Yardbirds releases their only British album, self-titled The Yardbirds. It was also known as Roger the Engineer due to the album's cover art of a psychedelic drawing of the album's engineer, Roger Cameron. The guitar work on the album is all played by Jeff Beck. The album touched some key aspects of psychedelia. Eastern sounds, woozy riffs, distortion, feedback, and sound effects, to name a few. Bass guitarist Paul Samuel Smith quoted on the album's psychedelic influence, up to this album, I never came across any LSD. Honestly, we were aware of drugs being around. They always are, but we didn't see or use any ourselves. Plenty of alcohol, but never more than good rock and roll amounts. Highlights from the album include Lost Woman, Over, Under, Sideways Down, and Jeff's Boogie. About a month prior to the album's release, Paul Samuel Smith left and was replaced by Jimmy Page. Los Angeles band The Birds released their third album, titled Fifth Dimension. It was the first album without Gene Clark, as he left the band prior to the recording of it. Highlights from the album include 5D, Fifth Dimension, Wild Mountain Time, Mr. Spaceman, What's Happening, 8 Miles High. As you can probably tell by some of the highlights, there were a few psychedelic tracks. In my opinion, this is the best Birds album, by the way. July 22nd, British blues band John Mayall and the Blues Breakers released the album Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton. It was the only album to feature Eric Clapton as a member. The album cover is highly well known, as well as it shows the four members sitting on a curbside with Eric Clapton reading a comic book. Members of the band were John Mayall, keyboards, piano, harmonica, and vocals, Eric Clapton, guitar and vocals, John McVie, bass guitar, and Huey Flint, drums. Clapton's guitar playing was so phenomenal, a fan graffitied on the North London Wall, "Eric Clapton is God." Highlights from the album include "All Your Love," "Hideaway," "Parchment Farm," and a cover of Robert Johnson's "Ramblin' on My Mind," which Eric Clapton took the lead vocals on. After the release of the album, Clapton left and went on to form Cream. Peter Green took his place on lead guitar. July 25th, Supremes released the 45 "You Can't Hurry Love." July 25th, British band The Troggs released the album "From Nowhere." Some of the album's highlights include "Wild Thing" and a cover of "Louie Louie." July 29th, British band Manfred Mann releases the Bob Dylan cover "Just Like a Woman." It featured new lead vocalist Mike Diabo and bass guitarist Klaus Voormann. Original lead vocalist Paul Jones embarked on a solo career, and the previous bassist Jack Bruce went on and joined Cream. On July 29th, Bob Dylan got into a motorcycle accident near Woodstock, New York, resulting in a neck injury. Speculations are rousing, saying the accident was a hoax due to the fact the police were not called at the scene and Dylan did not go to the hospital but instead to a town doctor. I found an online article which supports his cause. It was taken from an online website called groovyhistory.com, and it was written by Jacob Shelton, and it's called Bob Dylan's 1966 Motorcycle Accident, What Really Happened, and it was published on August 13th, 2019. On July 29th, 1966, the month after Blonde on Blonde was released, Bob Dylan crashes a motorcycle near Woodstock, New York. It was a mysterious event that put his career on hold for years and changed the course of rock history, but little is known of the actual event. What happened on that winding road in upstate New York? The demarcation is clear. From his second album, The Freewheeling Bob Dylan, from 1963, through Blonde on Blonde in 1966, Bob Dylan was a national figure, hailed by some as a folk music or rock messiah. It's pretty much a fact that Bob Dylan was the voice of a generation. Then he disappears. His return to music was gradual and considered all he missed. The 1967 Summer of Love, Noel Dylan, Monterey Pop in 67, or 68, well, it was in 67, but he wrote 68 here. I'm sorry. Noel Dylan, Woodstock in 69, Noel Dylan. He returned to recording, but his records were smaller in scale compared to the manic energy of his rock or electric period. Bringing It All Back Home from 1965, Highway 61 Revisited from 1965, and Blonde on Blonde in 1966, with the post-crash albums John Wesley Harding from 1967 and Nashville Skyline from 1969. All five of the albums are critically acclaimed and beloved by fans, but he was a change artist. In the 5 decades since the accident, the reality of his injuries has never been revealed, leaving the hours after the crash in a speculation and rumor. That Dylan purposely crashes Triumph motorcycle in order to escape the mounting fervor around his work. Did he break his neck? Or was it his collarbone? Was he really left with permanent brain damage from the accident? Or was the story just an excuse for the voice of a generation to take a vacation? In 1966, a star can get up to no good without anyone hearing about it. Even someone as famous as Bob Dylan could get into a potentially fatal motorcycle crash in upstate New York without so much as a peep. At the time of the accident, the only story about it was a two-sentence mention in the New York Times titled, "Dale and Hurt in Cycle Mishap." Without a police report of the accident, there is no way to determine what actually happened. All the eyewitnesses' reports of the accident come from people who saw the wreckage but not the incident. Dale's motorcycle accident is a bit like a tree falling in the woods. According to biographer Howard Sounds, Dylan's crash occurred directly after he left the house of his manager, Albert Grossman, as he rode near Stribo Road, a treacherous, curvy path that's unfriendly to all motorists, regardless of their vehicle or place in the pantheon of rock. During the ride, Dylan was being followed by Grossman and Grossman's wife, Sally, who were in a car. There's no minute-by-minute description of the ride, but it seems as if Dylan took off ahead of the Grossmans and ate pavement on a curve out of sight. Sally Grossman said that when they came upon Dylan, the singer was kind of moaning and groaning, but that he didn't look injured. Rather than go to a hospital, Dylan opened the door to be driven to the home of Dr. Ed Fowler, who lived about an hour away from the crash site in Middletown. This is where the conspiracies about what really happened to Dylan begin. If Dylan was really injured in the crash, then he shouldn't have been driven to a hospital or even airlifted. He's Bob Dylan. In 1966, people would have moved mountains to make sure he survived an accident. So why did he want to stay in the basement? Dylan probably wasn't on knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door, as Dr. Fowler's wife had claimed. It's more likely that he was either attempting to assuage Dale Eagle or continue building a myth that he'd been working on for a decade. Fowler's wife said that while Dylan was in their house for a month, he lived in the third floor bedroom, and despite claiming that he had a broken neck, he regularly ate dinner with the family and hung out with the members of the band. There's a band called The Band back then. I'm just clearing that up, okay. Anyway, Thayer doesn't believe that Dylan was lying about the accident, and she said he was a very polite guest. If anyone really knows what happened to Dylan, it should be Robbie Robertson from the band, the group that accompanied Dylan, the singer, on his world tour in 65 and in 66, and played on the massive collection of basement tapes following Dylan's accident. Robertson says that Dylan definitely hurt his neck in the accident, that he spent about 6 weeks in a neck brace. That time was beneficial to Dylan because it gave him time to think about the future and if he really wanted to be the voice of a generation or if he wanted to have some semblance of a normal life, Robertson said. People say, oh, he didn't have an accident. This was just so he could kick heroin or whatever. No. He fell off the motorcycle and fractured his neck, and he had to wear his brace on his neck for quite a while. I would say about 6 weeks. It was a long time. He couldn't turn his head. He had to turn his whole body to turn. And at the same time, he was going to another phase. He was going into this place of having kids and having a family. And this rock and roll lifestyle just didn't suit him anymore. As word about Dylan's accident spread through the underground, rumors about what actually happened to him ranged from the believable that he had broken his neck to more extreme stories about the performer. One story said that the wreck left Dylan transformed into a grotesque version of himself, that he was blind, no longer able to play guitar, let alone work on his announced novel, Tarantula. On top of the claims of his death, there were many imagined reasons behind the crash and his sudden disappearance. Dylan was an avid motorcycle rider. He'd been riding them since the 50s. Did he really lose control on a road he'd been on many times before? Was there an oil slick, or was it just the road was just wet? Some people believe that Dylan was overindulging amphetamines at the time. His heavy use that had unnerved the band while they were touring together in early 1966, and that he needed an excuse to detox in peace, so down in the pavement he went. Dylan was away from the world for long enough for rumors to swirl that he died in the accident, but at the very least those rumors were squashed when he released John Wesley Harding on December 27th, 1967. Even before the release of the album, Dylan was announcing himself to the world. While recovering in the West, Sagittarius in New York, he recorded an entire set of songs that were sent out for copyright. Even if he was gruesomely disfigured, at the very least, he was alive. Whether the motorcycle accident was as severe as Dylan's doctor claimed it was, the idea that Dylan was hurt beyond recognition was an excuse for him to disappear for a while, to stop being Bob Dylan. As an up-and-coming folky in the 1960s, Dylan was sought after by all manner of hangers-on and would-be groupies. Dylan says that he found the entire thing exhausting, and that the town of Woodstock, where he lived in 1966, had become a nightmare. In his memoir, he wrote that everything was wrong. The world was absurd. As soon as word of the motorcycle crash spread, Dylan canceled tour dates and put off public appearances. When a reporter from the New York Daily News tracked him down in Woodstock in 67, Dylan said that he'd been poring over books by people he'd never heard of while getting in touch with old friends. I had been in a motorcycle accident, and I'd been hurt, but I recovered. Truth was that I wanted to get out of the rat race, having children and changed my life, and segregated me from just about everybody and everything that was going on. Outside of my family, nothing held any real interest for me, and I was seeing everything through different glasses, which what Dylan wrote later of the incident. The man himself has rarely spoken about the accident. Whether it was real or imagined isn't important to Dylan. He likens the motorcycle crash and the mythology around it to a transfiguration or the complete change of form into a spiritual state. While speaking with Rolling Stone in 2012, he talked around the accident, and rather than give specific answers, he talked about what happened to him afterwards. He said, I had a motorcycle accident in 1966. I already explained to you about that. New and old, right? Now you can put this together any way you want. You can work on it any way you want. Transfiguration, you can go and learn about it from the Catholic Church. You can learn about it in some old mystical books. But it's a real concept. It's happening throughout the ages. Nobody knows who it's happened to or why. But you get real proof of it, and here and there. It's not like something you can dream up and think. It's not like conjuring up a reality, or like reincarnation, or like when you might think you're somebody from the past but have no proof. It's not anything to do with the past or the future. So when you ask some of your questions, you're asking them to a person who's long dead. You're asking them to a person that doesn't exist. But people make that mistake about me all the time. I lived through a lot. Have you ever heard of a book called No Man Knows My History? It's about Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet. The title could refer to me. Transfiguration is what allows you to crawl out from under the chaos and fly above it. That's how I could still do what I do and write the songs I sing and just keep on moving. And that's it of the article. July 31st, newly formed British supergroup Cream played their first gig at the Windsor Jazz and Blues Festival in the UK. Members were Eric Clapton, guitar and vocals, Jack Bruce, bass, guitar and harmonica and vocals, and Ginger Baker, drums and vocals. Eric Clapton formed Cream in response to the folk rock movement happening in Los Angeles, California. Cream's musical influence was blues. Both Clapton and Bruce were mostly the blues scholars. Ginger Baker, on the other hand, came from more of a jazz background. Ironically, after Cream had broken out, they became an influence to heavy metal bands from the 1980s. That's all I have. Anyway, thank you for tuning in to the Mark and the Pseudo podcast this week, today, and hope you enjoyed it, and get ready for the next one, which is August, which I am prepared for, but I'm going to do it separately. So next time, get ready for August of 1966 in the history of music, the Mark and the Pseudo podcast. Thank you. God bless. Good night.